For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. I'm very happy to have you all here and to introduce Haksho. Some of you have met him, but Haksho is our branching stream visiting priest for 6 months from San Francisco Zen Center and Sweden, who's here visiting and helping us out, and we'll be giving the talk tonight. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Taigen, for inviting me to give this talk, and thank you all for welcoming me into the Sangha. In a hospital in Los Angeles in 1993, a deranged woman walked into the emergency room with a gun in her hand. She was looking for one of the nurses who she believed to be the cause of her husband leaving her. She found her and shot her, wounded her, but didn't kill her. So the woman went running away, and she went chasing after her. And she came into the room where Nurse Joan Black was on duty that evening, and the call had just gone out moments before that there was a woman with a gun in the hospital. And Nurse Black saw this woman coming through the door. She put her arm around her and the other hand on the arm with the gun and started comforting her. And this woman broke down crying and started telling her story of how she felt she didn't have anything to live for anymore. So her husband had left her, and she comforted her and emphasized her and calmed her down and calmed the situation down. And as they asked her afterwards why she acted the way she did, Nurse Joan Black said, "I saw a sick person and I felt I had to take care of them." So I'm sharing this story because I think it illustrates how we see other people as well as ourselves. The way that we look at each other determines how we treat each other. If we see a killer or a murderer, then violence or some form of coercive action is what seems like the appropriate measure to take. But if we see somebody who's sick, then care and compassion is more naturally what we want to extend to them. There's a bit of a parallel story in dating back to the Pali Canon. It's a story of Angulimala. Some of you might know it, who was a young, very promising yogi studying under a Brahmin guru. He was kind of the most promising student, and because of that, some of the other students got jealous of him, and they got the teacher to believe that Angulimala, whose name at the time was Ahimsaka, was the non-harming one, was having an affair with the guru's teacher, the guru's wife. And so the guru got jealous, and his way of punishing and expounding his student was to tell him that he had now graduated his studies, and but in order to fully graduate, he'd had to give his teacher a gift, which was 1,000 fingers taken from 1,000 victims. So Angulimala blindly had to follow his teacher's instructions and set out on this path. He became quite a deranged person through these horrible acts that he was committing. And after killing 999 people, he came across the Buddha. He saw the Buddha walking and he ran towards him. And supposedly because of the Buddha's supernatural powers, he could not catch up with him. And eventually he yelled, "Stop!" And the Buddha turned around and said, "I have already stopped. Now you stop." And Angulimala came to his senses, realized that the life that he'd been living was not the one he wanted to live, and joined the Sangha. And as the story told, was enlightened, became an arhat, and was later stoned to death because of his previous karma. Part of the story, while I'm telling a story, is that the Buddha was appealing to his better self, knowing that there was somebody there that did not want to live that kind of life, causing suffering to himself, to others, and himself. And it's an example in the Buddhist tradition of somebody, you know, that everybody has the potential to awaken, even somebody with such heavy load of karma. And we've been studying the Lotus Sutra, and similarly it's the Devadatta, the Buddha's cousin, in chapter 12, that's given this reassurance of his future Buddhahood too. And it's also a story of how somebody doing a lot of harm out of blindly following the order of somebody given by some authority, influenced by somebody else's ideas and somebody else's karma. It's the blind leading the blind. And so we just had the service for the victims of the horrible shooting in Orlando. And I went online and looked to see what I could find about the perpetrator today. My guess was that he was a young man, which is 29. And I feel it's unfortunate. It's often young men who are most susceptible to ideas of violence and falling out on them. So Omar Mateen is 29. Is mentally ill, bipolar, and is claiming think they're not seeing a relationship to ISIS, but certainly influenced by those ideas. So these stories exist with us today. There's another parallel with the nurse Joan Black and the Buddha. Actually, is that the Buddha is often likened to a physician, and particularly in expounding the Four Noble Truths, as sort of having the structure of a doctor, of finding the cause, you know, first diagnosing their suffering, this dukkha, this unsatisfactoriness, and diagnosing it and finding the cause to be ignorance of the nature of reality, of our inseparability from all things and people around us, and how that's the cause of the other two poisons of greed and hate. We're trying to, when we're separate, believe ourselves to be separate from those around us, we try to bring more pleasurable and things into the realm of I and mine, and to push away those things that seem unpleasant or fearful to us. So we try to build a fortress or support ourselves, this small me, from this big world out there. And then the third noble truth being that there is an end to suffering, and the fourth one actually being the cure, prescribing the cure of Noble Eightfold Path. So I think this is part of what Buddhism has to say about human nature, which we may lose faith in these, when these horrible crimes happen. But this sort of, to essentialize it, is that we're not, human beings aren't bad, we're just confused, and some are more confused than others, and they are worthy of our compassion too, especially. So those are some extreme examples of extreme actions taken by confused people. Most of us, more benign confusions, fortunately causing less suffering. But I wanted to spend a little time too on how we, because I think we still have an internalized story that our society has been telling us, largely we've inherited, of human nature that's kind of negative, and it's influencing our behavior and our actions too, and limiting our more benevolent and compassionate and actions, as well as the ones to actually try to create positive change in the world. And some of these are in, you know, little phrases like, we say, the law of the jungle, right? It's like, this is how, or philosopher Thomas Hobbes had the expression, the life of the savage man, you know, sort of outside of society, that's keeping people in check, is nasty, brutish, and short. But if humans left to their own devices, we would just be killing each other. And so we need some of structure and support in order to, or, you know, and punitive justice system, etc., to prevent us from acting in this way. I think there's some good studies saying that that's actually not what we would do. I was talking to Tagin about Rebecca Solnit's book on crisis and societies. The problem. And how it's actually when things fall apart, these institutions and structures we usually depend on, people tend to bond together and support each other beautifully. And so some of these negative stories are, I think, coming from the sort of Judeo-Christian tradition that many of us are from, but it's also being, I think, some of our science is being hijacked to reaffirm this belief too. I brought a quote from Richard Dawkins, who wrote this influential book, The Selfish Gene, a number of years ago. And just a couple of sentences in here. He says, "Natural selection favors genes which control their survival machines in such a way that they make the best use of their environment. This includes making the best use of other survival machines, both of the same and of different species." It's a very negative view of human nature as these machines that kind of mechanically are just running to try to, and all that we really focused on is surviving and maximizing our own survival, no matter what the expense to the world around us. So it's I don't think it's so extreme, though. I think that's kind of, we've been fed this, a lot of this story. And to counter it, before I get into the Buddha said. It's this article from written by George Monbiot, who's one of the leading, at least in Europe, one of the leading environmental writers. And this came in the, wrote this in the fall of last year, and in between, you know, this is in the build-up to the Paris Climate Summit, and so in between what he was writing about that, he published this article on human nature, basically. And it's called, "We're Not as Selfish as We Think We Are. Here's the Proof." It's a very clear title. It starts with saying, "Do you find yourself thrashing against the tide of human indifference and selfishness? Are you oppressed by the sense that while you care, others don't? That because of humankind's callousness, civilization and the rest of life on Earth are basically stuffed? If so, you're not alone, but neither are you right." And he goes on to cite the study of the Common Cause Foundation, and they had two transformative findings. One was that a large majority, 74%, identifies more strongly with unselfish values than with selfish values. This means that they are more interested in helpfulness, honesty, forgiveness, and justice than in money, fame, status, and power. And the second finding was a similar majority, to that we tend to believe others to be more selfish than they actually are. In other words, we made a terrible mistake about other people's minds. And it goes on to say that while chimpanzees, on the one hand, behave a little more like the Homo economicus of neoliberal mythology, humans, on the other hand, are ultra-social, possessed of an enhanced capacity for empathy, an unparalleled sensitivity to the needs of others, a unique level of concern about their welfare, and an ability to create moral norms that generalize and enforce these tendencies. And he goes on to say some about why we might have created such a negative view of ourselves, and it was a little about what I touched on, so I'm not going to go into that. But the second finding was that we tend to have a more negative view on other people's minds than what the reality actually is. And he points it out that, interestingly and alarmingly for people of my political persuasion, it is also discovered that liberals tend to possess a dimmer view of other people than conservatives do. So, do you want to grow the electorate? Do you want progressive politics to flourish? Then spread the word that other people are broadly well-intentioned. And he says that this negative self-image then actually is pointing that the real danger that we need to confront is not a general selfishness, but a general passivity. Billions of decent people tut and shake their heads as the world burns, immobilized by the conviction that nobody else cares. Last says, "You are not alone. The world is with you, even if it has not yet found its voice." And so, from a Buddhist point of view, and pointed to the Buddhist teachings, we've already been studying the Lotus Sutra and exclamations of everybody's eventual awakening and the celebration of that. And this dates as far back as to the teachings on Buddha nature, to the Pali Canon, to the Pabbasara Sutta. The Buddha is said to have said, "The mind, O monks, is luminous. Only it is defiled by adventitious defilements from without." And this is similar to an image that I came across when I, and would, kind of got me hooked on Buddhism, I think. I had been reading, I think it was in the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, because that's the first book I was reading. And Buddhist philosophy was attractive to me, but I have this memory of human nature being described. There was this kind of luminous core that could not be seen because it's all, you know, these sort of defilements being this fog. And then the idea of practice then, if you can get rid of the defilements, then you can see this luminous core, and that's, I guess, enlightenment. There's this Zen twist to that, you know, where this is basically this would be a dualistic understanding, like to rid ourselves of the delusions, to get rid of them so that we, and that is enlightenment. It's a Mahayana twist in some sense of nirvana and samsara not being separate. I think our practice instead is to see our delusions for what they are, and to awaken with them and through them. There's a line in the Genjo Koan, Dogen saying, those who are enlightened about delusions are Buddhas, those who are deluded about enlightenment are sentient beings. So this is sort of our delusions is what we've got to work with, actually, and it's a little like we might call, sometimes called kitchen waste, which if we actually treat that appropriately is become the food, you know, it's compost, it can full of life, and this potential for further life to grow in this rich humus soil that's produced if you treat it appropriately. And I think our delusions are similar if we can care for them. And I think the second sort of Zen twist that I see on this is again Dogen's teachings and on sort of practice realization, not being separate. So rather than trying to get rid of all our defilements and then we awaken, we have the potential for enlightened activity in each moment, no matter what our past is like. In this moment, right here and now, we have the potential to manifest awakening in zazen and in our actions of body, speech, and mind. That's basically what I wanted to say. Can I borrow your chant book there? I thought I wanted to close with some of the lines of the Metta Sutta that we just chanted. Seems appropriate for the evening. May all beings be happy. May they be joyous and live in safety. All living beings, whether weak or strong, in high or middle or low realms of existence, small or great, visible or invisible, near or far, born or to be born, may all beings be happy. Thank you.
Does anyone have comments, questions, responses? If you can add, please feel free.
Yeah, Ben.
So I wanted to thank you for giving a hopeful and inspiring talk in a moment when it would be easy to not be hopeful. So I teach, when I teach introduction to cultural anthropology classes, I often have my students read about societies that live outside of a hierarchical state and outside of the free market capitalist system. And I point out to them, and this is pretty consistent, that those societies are characterized not, their life isn't nasty, brutish, and short. They're characterized by sharing and reciprocity and people caring for each other. And sometimes my students will say, oh, well, that's fine, but we live in a world where people don't do that. We live in a modern world. We can't act that way. And so I ask them, so who do you share with? And they say, well, my family. Do you share with anybody else? Well, with my friends. And then I ask them, do any of you share with strangers? Inspire with me to share anything with a stranger. And so then I ask them, who here has given somebody directions? And everybody raises their hands. And I say, see, you share with strangers all the time. You just don't realize that you do this. And that that capacity for reciprocity and sharing and caring for others exists in our society as it does in societies different than ours too.
Yeah. Thank you.
So it's nice to remember that people do want to care for each other and help each other too.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you. I used to do a fair bit of hitchhiking years ago, and I think it's a great practice for really being reminded of, you know, the kindness that exists among total strangers, that people just pulling up and stopping and taking you, going out of their way, taking without having any previous relationship, just seeing a fellow human being on the road. And of course, not every car stops, but some do. Yeah. Any other questions or comments?
I think to talk about human nature right now in these times, there's such an atmosphere of demonizing some groups of people who we have to keep out or whatever. Mm-hmm. And just to see that as ignorance, I think is helpful. To see that we sometimes there's willful ignorance and racism is something that kind of ignorance is something that is still educated, it's not natural. Homophobia is something that this guy in Orlando in this case is still looking at him somehow. It seems like his father had that too. And so it's not something that's natural or necessary to him. You were talking about Western culture where there's this like assumption of evil or sin or something like that. Buddhist idea is to see the possibility anyway. To turn it and see it that way, the possibility of education and overcoming ignorance. There's more possibilities.
Yeah. I heard, I can't remember exactly where I heard it, but just military training or something is all about this. I think that if you, in order to kill or, you know, cause a kind of harm to a human being, you have to sort of dehumanize them, you know, in some way. And there's, we can do that. We have the capacity to do that conceptually by putting labels on the people that somehow justifies our actions, but I think similarly we have the capacity to put labels on people that will allow us to treat them kindly as, you know, as brothers and sisters.
The talk about human nature resonated with me in my teaching. One of the things that struck me and that I think about in the face of this kind of thing that went on yesterday is that researchers who, you know, as they've branched out and started studying all kinds of people and all kinds of cultures as opposed to what more American college students are finding more and more that what we are seems to completely reflect the assumptions we make about what we are and the institutions we build around those assumptions. So that Americans make ourselves selfish and competitive by assuming that people are selfish and competitive and structuring institutions to deal with selfishness and competitiveness, and we don't find those other places.
Right.
This has always struck me as really resonant with the idea that we're imprisoning ourselves. Get more and more concerned about that the more I have to listen to and agree with the subjects
Yeah, thank you. I was tempted to go into how our institutions have, you know, like this negative view of human nature lies at the base of a lot of institutions that are then reinforcing it and, you know, promoting selfish behavior. Our economy being the clearest example, but yeah, a lot of it. So, and but I think that's why we as Buddhists have an important role to play to counter that negative self-image that lies at the root of a lot of this.
Let me ask you, since you're Swedish, and I think some of us have some tendency to romanticize Sweden as an enlightened society, maybe, but what was your impression coming to America of the difference?
Oh, as far as, yeah.
Just the way people treat each other.
Yeah. It's tricky because I've lived basically my whole time in America within a Buddhist institution. So it's been
since you come to Chicago.
Yeah, and even then, a lot of my life is within the sangha. But it seems to be more, I don't know, complex or sort of negative self-image of not being enough, or, you know, sort of more self-judgment, I think. And sort of, yeah, fear and anxiety about not being good enough. Yeah.
So, it's instructive. It's reminded me of something my sister shared with me before she passed away. She gave me a copy of the movie Happy. And it's supposed to be a documentary. That the scientists actually ask people what makes them happy, and they found out at the end that they're putting, you know, electroencephalograms on people and doing different things, that people were happiest when they were helping others.
Yeah.
And that was the deal. So we talk about societies and how we treat strangers or, you know, treat each other, people we know. And that's where our true happiness is. And as we were talking about in the car when we drove down here tonight, just something like Orlando strikes you so hard, makes you so scared, makes you so angry. And the word you use, which really brought to me, makes us confused. We forget. And we don't realize for a moment that what makes us happiest is when we're helping others. When we get scared, we hang on, we fight. And it's what makes something like Orlando so impactful, because it drives that wedge into us. Or I allow, as you said, I get so frightened by it, I'm so angry at it, that it makes me forget the other lessons that we learned.
Yeah, and this scientific finding that we're happiest when we're helping others seems totally in line with Buddhist teachings of if we're not really separate from the world around us, you know, then of course if your happiness is going to be my happiness too.
Right. Yeah. You're totally non-Buddhist. Non-Buddhist, but it's the essence, I guess, in a way, of our teaching.
Yeah.